Hello and welcome along to this week's edition of Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley. This is the programme that aims to get you thinking with conversations that matter every Saturday here on Premier Christian Radio and all over the world any time of the day or week via podcast and our YouTube channel as well. And today, hallucinogenic and psychedelic drugs are for and against on the programme. I'll introduce our guests in a moment. For more from the show, make sure you subscribe to our newsletter. More and more people are doing that, and you can do it by visiting our show page at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. If you're listening via podcast, the links are with today's show. More resources there and ways to support the show too. Loads of interesting things that we're launching this autumn. Further apologetics resources, videos, podcasts, and all sorts. So it's a hive of activity at Unbelievable headquarters at Premier at the moment, but we'll be revealing more as the weeks go on. Later on in today's show, by the way, Ben Jacobs of Genexis will be joining me. Genexis is back with in-person events in Coventry and London towards the end of this month. Some really exciting speakers too. People like John Lennox, N.T. Wright, Paul Davies and Tom Holland, among others. All names you'll recognise from Unbelievable and The Big Conversation. And those are the kinds of topics and shows and people that they're interested in featuring as well. So listen out for that later on in the show. Right now, though, time to get into today's debate.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, today we're talking about getting high with the Most High. Are hallucinogenic drugs a pathway to spiritual enlightenment? And my guests today are Ashley Landy and Peter Sherstedt Hughes. Now, Ashley Landy rejected her childhood faith as a young adult and instead pursued enlightenment through hallucinogens and psychedelic drugs. In fact, she was a regular user of mushrooms and LSD. However, after a series of bad trips, she came to believe there was a negative spiritual dimension to the use of psychedelics. She left the drugs behind. She became a Christian. My other guest is Dr. Peter Sherstedt Hughes. He's a philosopher who specializes in research pertaining to panpsychism and altered states of mind. Now, he's actually an advocate of the use of psychedelics to understand consciousness and perhaps to expand the limits of our understanding of spirituality and indeed existence. So we're going to be looking at this whole area today, asking why has psychedelics been enjoying something of a renaissance recently in popularity, whether hallucinogenic drugs could be some kind of a pathway to enlightenment, or whether they might be ultimately a spiritual dead end. So welcome, Ashley and Peter, to the show. Great to have you both with me today.
Thank you.
Let's get a little bit of both of your experiences in this area. Ashley, first of all, it's going to have to be the short version, and there's a great article I'll direct people to where you tell your story in a lot more depth. But tell us, how you got into psychedelics and that kind of thing, first of all.
Okay, sure. I will do my best to keep it brief. So I was raised in a marginally Christian home. I had a wonderful childhood in many ways, and my parents got much stronger in their faith after I had become an adult. But as a child, faith and religious instruction, spiritual instruction wasn't a big part of my childhood. And so it was quite easy. We did go to a Methodist church service most Sundays, but it was kind of compartmentalized. It didn't really bleed into the rest of our lives. And so it was quite easy for me when I believe I was 14, to just disavow all of it. And my parents were pretty scandalized, but there wasn't necessarily an intervention at that time. We were having a lot of stressful family events at that time. So sadly, I made it that much worse for my parents. And so that continued. I've always been a reader and enjoyed reading. So at that time, I read a variety of things, the Beat Poets, William Burroughs, Jack Kerouac. I think I read The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test by Tom Wolfe, and I found it kind of fascinating. I was intrigued by psychedelic usage. But not to the extent. My husband, on the other hand, he loved the Beatles. And so by the time he was 11, he said, someday I'm taking LSD. I wasn't necessarily like that. And I smoked marijuana a couple times as a teenager, but it didn't really catch my fancy. It wasn't a big deal. When I got to college, I sampled a few other different drugs, not psychedelics yet, but really alcohol was the big thing for me. Just got into binge drinking and partying, and I enjoyed that alteration of consciousness, even though it was ultimately a destructive and soul siphoning mode of consciousness. But it was my senior year in college. One of my friends came over with some psilocybin mushrooms, and I was intrigued. I didn't really have a lot of knowledge in that area, but I said, you know, why the heck not? Sure, let's take them. And we did. And it was a very enchanting experience. It felt very magical. It wasn't spiritual for me at that point. There was nothing to really shake up my atheism at that point. I don't think I thought that deeply about whether I was experiencing a supernatural dimension or it was just this epiphenomena of my mind. I didn't think about it that deeply, but I just thought it was really fun and it was really cool and neat.
What was the actual experience that you had at that point? What can you describe sort of what this actually felt like when you actually started engaging in this?
Sure. Yeah. Well, there was certainly a distortion of perceptions. Things just appeared differently. Colors moved. Like I looked deeply into the grain of wood, I could see it moving and transforming. And there would be eyes that would emerge from wood or from rocks. I remember my best friend and I, she also took the mushrooms, and we sat and stared at a photo in National Geographic for what seemed like hours, just trying to figure out what it was. And it turned out it was the back of a Shetland pony in Wales, actually. I remember listening, I put on an Electric Light Orchestra record, and the music was cutting in and out and swelling and decrescendoing. And I thought that was really interesting. When we went outside, it seemed like the air was glittering. It seemed like emerging into the outside world was like emerging into a new dimension, you know, it's a whole new world. So there was an aspect of it. It made things seem fresh and new and different. And it was unlike anything that I had ever experienced before.
You were having these experiences and obviously these captured you quite significantly, didn't they? So what, mm-hmm.
Yes.
And were they overall a very positive experience? Were you feeling like, yeah, this is something that's kind of enhancing my life? What would you say were the kind of benefits that you were experiencing from your use of psychedelics?
I mean, I would have said that, I think at that time I would have said that it enhanced my creativity, but it was all a very inwardly directed, any kind of transformation that I would have said I experienced was very inwardly directed. I don't know that by anyone else's metrics, it would have made me a better person. I mean, I was still a pretty adamant atheist. I was something of a misanthrope. I wasn't very nice to people outside of my friends. I was very judgmental. So I think I would have thought that I was embarking on this inward journey. And then as far as the experiences being by and large positive, once I encountered LSD, mushrooms for me at that point were just more, they were fun, they were a good time, they were fascinating and enchanting. You know, psychedelics, I would say they cast a spell in a way. But my first experience on LSD was emotionally, psychologically, spiritually shattering. And I certainly experienced the classic ego death that is referenced in lots of psychedelic literature. And I remember in the aftermath, I was just so shell-shocked that I found it difficult to conduct day-to-day life. I was working at a newspaper at the time, and I just found it difficult to stay motivated in my job and just to even do basic toiletry functions. I was just so shell-shocked, and I remember I couldn't decide whether what had happened was good or bad. But 2 weeks later, and I said, if I ever do that again, I'll do it maybe once a year. And then 2 weeks later, I was looking for LSD again. So that kind of was my embarkation on what I would call my love affair with psychedelics. I mean, LSD in particular was my idol. It was my love. It was my greatest enemy too. And actually the worst experience, I mean, I think the bad trips certainly were devastating and led me to question the nature of the experience and what I was doing to myself. But the very worst trip I had was actually quite early on with my experience with LSD. So that alone, I think, was not enough to make me quit or to make me believe that perhaps pursuing enlightenment through psychedelics was a dead end at that point.
Yeah. Well, we'll come to the story of where things went from there, if you like,
okay.
In a moment.
Okay.
But let me introduce my other guest, Peter. Peter Sjöstedt Hughes is a philosopher, as I mentioned, who specializes in really looking into this whole area. And you're something of an advocate, I think, Peter, for the value potentially of hallucinogenic drugs. I mean, do you mind telling me first of all whether you've had your own personal experiences? I'm assuming yes, on psychedelics.
Yes, I have, and my route's very different from Ashley's. Quite the contrary, in many ways. The only similarity is I started with psilocybin mushrooms, if you exclude, you know, alcohol and so on. So my route was, I never really took drugs as a teenager or youth, you know, or in my 20s, really, early 20s. And I was teaching, philosophy and philosophy of religion and partly and philosophy of mind. And I was asked on the syllabus, there was, you know, different arguments for the, let's say, you know, for God and for the spiritual or the transcendent. And one of those was from William James, the great philosopher, psychologist William James, especially from his book, The Varieties of Religious Experience, published in 1902. And in it, he says, you know, alcohol is the first step of the mystical consciousness. But then he goes into nitrous oxide, ether, and so on, and other intoxicants. And he speaks about how they are all part and parcel of the mystical experience. So this is a debate in itself, whether the mystical experience from sort of, religious legacies are the same as those induced by psychedelics. We can speak about that before. But anyway, it interested me because I had never experienced anything like that, you know, anything outside of ordinary consciousness, if you accept that term. So one day I was walking around a field with my brother, and he said to me, Peter, I think these are magic mushrooms down here. And so I picked about 70 of them, and I dried them, and I checked on the internet that they were safe and so on and so forth. I think they were the Liberty Caps. And I took a little dose in my London flat at the time, and there was not much effect. But I went to the cinema and watched what I thought was a 3D film, but it turned out to be 2D, I realised later. So small effect. And then I took a large dose about a week later. And that was, you know, it was so incredible. It's so incredible. I mean, it was so, as Ashley was saying, I mean, it was so beautiful, sublime. I was travelling through space, meeting aliens, all kinds of things I've written in my book. But anyway, it was a life-changing event, really. And I thought, wow. I always thought psychedelics were just like, you know, kaleidoscopic colours and so on and so forth. But it was so much more than that. It was like the fusion of concepts and percepts, the slowing down of time and space, which is very interesting for a philosopher, really. And so I thought, okay, I'll read the literature on it. And there wasn't much. I mean, there's William James, obviously. And later I've discovered other writers like H.H. Price and John Smithies and Gerald Hurd and so on. But not much, relatively speaking. So then I thought, okay, I'll start writing something, you know, just to get people interested. And that sort of put me on this trajectory where I looked into it more and more. I should say as well, another important, I suppose, for this show feature is that I was brought up, I wouldn't say I was brought up as an atheist, but I mean, that was the default view here in Cornwall, a very secular county, really. And also I'm half Swedish, and Sweden's one of the most secular countries in Europe, that in Czech Republic, I believe. So it was, you know, Christianity, religion was just something very strange to me. So I would say, but, you know, the psychedelics actually made me much more interested in theology, especially mysticism, the mystical aspect of theology, and brought me closer that way, I would say.
Do you have a particular label that you wear? Would you describe yourself as an atheist, or would you say you're somewhere, I don't know, agnostic, because you think there might be something more than just the natural, purely natural realm when it comes to this sort of stuff going on?
Well, I wouldn't call myself a Christian or any traditional religion, but I wouldn't really use the word atheist anymore because, you know, I've done a lot of research on Spinoza recently, and he's, you know, the first pantheist, really, or the most famous pantheist. Pantheism was coined for him. And he says that God is nature, you know. And by nature, he doesn't mean physical nature. He means something much more than that. So I'm interested in looking at Spinozism in relation to psychedelic experience, unity experiences, and so on and so forth. So, I mean, I call myself perhaps a monist, which means that mind and matter are the same thing, but not just brain matter. I call myself a panpsychist, which means that minds are ubiquitous in nature. So they're not just in advanced mammals. They're in plants as well, to a basic extent, like the Greeks believed. And I don't know what other labels I've got. Moral anti-realist. Blah, blah, blah. But I wouldn't, nothing common, nothing normal. You know?
Right. No. But it sounds like you're not a hard naturalist in the sense of a, I don't know, a Daniel Dennett who believes that, you know, consciousness is purely a result of physical phenomena in that sense.
No. I mean, I consider
that.
Yeah, that's fair. I'm not a physicalist in that sense. And I think that in it, physicalism is a religion in itself. I mean, it's an ideology. And you look at the history of that with Galileo, Descartes and so on, Hobbes. You see why we're in the state we're in, where we cannot explain the relationship between mind and matter. And that's why I'm particularly interested in psychedelics, because of that relation.
Well, I'd love to come back to all of that in a way, but I want to keep this also very much in the realm of experience as well, because that's primarily where Ashley has come from in this whole story. Take us a bit further on in your journey then, Ashley, because what, you know, you were obviously deep into using the psychedelics. You were using them on a regular basis. They were giving a sort of sense of, I suppose, purpose, or at least taking you outside of your normal everyday in the way that you were using them.
Yes.
What ultimately changed for you? Why did they eventually for you become a spiritual dead end rather than a kind of an enlightening thing ultimately?
Yeah, I think just the trajectory was ever downward with psychedelics. And I think that's the nature of an idol that we see in the Bible. That's the nature of an idol, that it's very attractive and seductive at first, and ultimately it hollows you out. And I just felt like it was a dead end, like it was a void, it was an abyss, I was getting nowhere. And I realized too that, and this is after years of using LSD fairly frequently, and also being very immersed in yogic philosophy, you know, dabbling in a variety of, so the term New Age is kind of an umbrella that encompasses a lot of different things, but dabbling in all these different healing modalities and all these different philosophies, and also regularly taking psychedelics and regularly experiencing ego death, I was no better of a person. I was still this wretched, miserable person.
Just help me to understand this concept that you've both mentioned a couple of times now, ego death, because this might not be immediately obvious to people watching or listening. What is this experience, and why does it get produced regularly with taking something like LSD? Ashley, if you'll kick us off on that.
Okay, yeah, and Pete, I'm sure Peter could explain this in a much more sophisticated philosophical manner than I will be able to do. But experientially, I can say it feels like death. It feels like the known world is crumbling. It feels like your identity is crumbling. The first time I experienced it was my first experience on LSD. I was beginning to sink into this panic, which the psychedelics are such an amplifier, and the level of panic and terror that you can feel on them if you begin to panic and terror and be terrified are amplified so far beyond. I mean, I've experienced anxiety and panic attacks in quote unquote normative consciousness, but in psychedelic, when you're on psychedelics, it's just amplified to a point where it feels like the entire world is sinking into an abyss, never to return. It feels like it's interminable, like it's going to go on forever. And then I remember saying, I need to go to the hospital. I'm dying. It really feels like you are actually dying. And then it felt like, and I want to be cautious too, and I because of my posture, I do not want to make psychedelics sound appealing or pique anyone's interest, but I feel like describing it is also important. And so the sky cracked open, this light poured in, and I felt like I had been compressed and compressed and compressed. And then I had come out this tunnel on the other side into open space. And it felt like there was a, and I could say a lot about this too, but there was a mimicry, I feel like, of the death and resurrection that we experience, the reality of which, I believe, is in Jesus Christ. And I think there's a mimicry of that. The mimicry of it was counterfeit and didn't have power to affect enduring transformation, I believe. But, it's difficult to describe. Perhaps Peter could take a better stab at it.
Well, yeah, go ahead, Peter. Tell us how would you describe, because I often hear, you know, of people who go on trips saying, oh, I felt at one with everything. And I assume this is the kind of what ego death is, this idea of there's no longer a me, there's just kind of meaning and consciousness and reality. Now, having not had any of these experiences, I wouldn't know exactly, but is that the idea? What could you give it more flesh?
Well, ego loss is one one term that is used for what traditionally is called unity experiences. In the Christian tradition, it's referred to as unio mystica. So this is, yeah, a feeling of both, well, there's two aspects to it, really. First of all, losing yourself, that's ego loss, but you thereby also seemingly connect with a greater whole. And this is very, I mean, I must say, Ashley painted it in very negative, like a very negative way. For a lot of people, it's very life-affirming. It can be very terrifying as well, but there are both aspects to that. Like I say, there's a Christian tradition, Judeo-Christian tradition of this as well, of course. So you lose your sense of self. So you forget, you don't not forget, you just don't realize who you are. You lose concepts, basically. You lose all modes of thinking, concepts, percepts, memories, and so on. So you have no awareness, no self-consciousness. You don't know that you are you. You don't know anything. You can't see anything, or you're not sensible to anything. In a way, it's like a complete blackout, except it's the complete opposite. It's also sometimes referred to as a whiteout, especially with a psychedelic, intense psychedelic drug like 5-MeO-DMT, which induces it, as far as I know, as potently as possible. It's just a complete, you know, quick, within a few seconds, you're losing everything. You can't see anything, and then, boom, it retrospectively feels as if time stopped, or you enter a state of timelessness. It's very interesting when you look at certain theologies of a God being eternal, meaning without time, outside of time, rather than infinite within time, an old theological debate, I believe. Anyway, it's almost like an experiential... it's almost like an experience of what we can only, philosophers and theologians have only spoken about theoretically. That's what makes it quite fascinating to me. Of course, losing yourself for people who are not used to it is very terrifying.
Yeah, and I was going to say, obviously, the way Peter speaks of this, Ashley, is obviously in sort of a kind of enlightening, you know, this is an experience that kind of connects you in a radically new way and causes some of the typical boundaries, you know, that we experience, physical limitations, to fall away in some fashion. And I'm sure many, many people have interpreted this as an amazing spiritual experience, you know, and we've got, you know, the whole of the 60s and the music that came out of these experiences.
Yeah, I had those experiences as well. I should say it wasn't all terror. And, you know, I had those experiences that felt very unitive and felt joyful and felt ecstatic at the time. So, I mean, I wouldn't have kept going back if you know, there wasn't something good that I perceived as good in the dark.
It's so powerful. I wouldn't necessarily go back, or at least I would be very hesitant to take it too much. I mean, it's so overwhelmingly powerful, it can be, that it's really not recreational at all. You know, it's really, I mean, you don't need to call it religious, but it's an intense experience, whatever it means. You know?
Evidently, it's an intense experience. It's a experience that I imagine a lot of people kind of, it's quasi-religious in the way that it obviously has this very intense effect. I mean, Ashley, so just sort of take us on the road to obviously you'd rejected faith, you were into the psychedelic drugs, you were having these experiences, but then you had some particularly negative ones. Was it the negativity that eventually sort of propelled you away from it, or was it a kind of diminishing returns ultimately on the experiences you were having, and what I suppose ultimately took you to Christianity? And I suppose lots of questions here, forgive me, but and is in your view the use of hallucinogens and being a Christian, are they mutually exclusive as far as you're concerned? But yeah, go ahead, Ashley.
Yes. and there were certainly diminishing returns involved. I got to the point where I could no longer have a good trip on LSD, no matter if it was two hits or, you know, sometimes I would microdose, which to me, microdose was a fourth of a hit. I guess contemporarily among people who are practicing it now, it's like a 10th or 20th of a hit, which I have difficulty understanding how that would even do anything. But there was, like I said, there was absolutely a downward trajectory. There were several other things happening in my life at the time. I think my husband and I had just gotten to a point of spiritual desolation and desperation. And we both had tried so many different roads, and they had all turned out to be dead ends. You know, LSD itself was turning out to be a dead end. And at that point, of course, I thought, and this, you know, you can read the long version of this in my essay, I thought, well, maybe the problem, I had all these rationalizations in my mind, and I thought, well, maybe the problem is chemical. Like, maybe the fact that LSD is a quote unquote synthetic chemical. Maybe I should go back to mushrooms. And so I grew my own mushrooms, and my thinking was I can just speak the right words over them, and I can pray over them with whatever, you know, whatever words I would have prayed at that point. And then I had a horrible time. And I remember at one point during that final mushroom trip, and it was quite strong, I was pacing around the house that we lived in at the time. There was a living room and then a bedroom, a Jack and Jill bathroom and another bedroom. So you could just go. I felt like I was wearing a rut in the floor going around and around. And I kept saying, where is God? I can't find him. I don't know where God is. And it felt like I was just missing him, and he was rushing around, you know, and I would kind of see tracers. I imagine I could see tracers of his robe. If God wears a robe, I don't know. But it was very sorrowful. It was deeply, deeply sorrowful. It seems kind of comical to retell it, but it was deeply sorrowful. And so after that point, I felt like I was done. I was done. And my husband at that point was actually beginning to be interested in Eastern Orthodox Christianity. And he was seeing a psychologist who recommended to him that he try this church, Jacob's Well, in the area in Kansas City where we lived at the time. And I said, no, absolutely not. I'm not. On the one hand, I was, you know, in a place of spiritual desolation, but I was still absolutely, completely resistant to Christianity while simultaneously being open to virtually anything else. But I said, no, absolutely not. And he started going. I held out for a long time, probably 6 months. And during that time, I became pregnant with our second child. And also, I had a dear friend from childhood who was a Christian who lost her 2-year-old daughter to leukemia in a very quick time period. From diagnosis to death was just 3 months. And that really had a profound effect on me, seeing her and her husband's peace in the midst. Of course, they were mourning intensely, but seeing their peace in the midst of this. And I had stayed in touch with her since childhood, and I think she probably knew that I was into drugs, and I would, whenever I visited with her, I would babble on, you know, prattle on about whatever New Age theory I was into at the time. And she's a very gentle person, and she would respond with Bible verses. And I would just say, oh, well, whatever, that's her thing, you know, I know better. But just seeing, witnessing her process of grieving and the hope that she had in the midst of it through her daughter dying really had a profound effect on me. And then when I was around 8 months pregnant, I finally conceded to go to church with my husband. And I remember I sat near the back, you know, like a sullen teenager. I was just sitting there. I didn't want to be there. But I just remember being overcome with emotion, awash with emotion, and beginning to weep during the worship portion of the service. And that's when I really started to think maybe that was like a little fissure in my hardened heart that I thought maybe there's something to this Jesus person, even though I could rationalize that too. And I did at the time say, well, I'm pregnant, I'm hormonal, you know, and I'm not someone who could ever be accused of being out of touch with my emotions as it is. But so, yeah, that was the beginning for me.
We'll talk about the way, you know, in the next section of the program, the way that others have sort of linked psychedelics to religious experience and everything else. Because that might be interesting to chase up as well. But we're talking today on the show about hallucinogenic drugs. Are they a pathway to spiritual enlightenment? Is it okay to get high with the Most High? Ashley Landy and Peter Sherstedt Hughes are my guests on the show today. And we'll be back in just a moment.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the show. Today we're talking about hallucinogenic drugs, psychedelics, and whether they are a path to spiritual enlightenment. Sort of speaking in favour of hallucinogens is Dr. Peter Sherstedt Hughes. He's a philosopher specialising in research in this sort of area. Ashley Landy has been talking about her own journey with psychedelics and how she decided to turn her back on it and become a Christian eventually. As we've mentioned, there's a longer version of her story that you can read in Fathom magazine, and it's a great article online. I'll make sure there's a link to it. It's called Acid Head, God Took Me Higher. But returning to you, first of all, Peter, obviously you've heard the sort of the negative side of this. Ashley ultimately felt like there was diminishing returns on this. She was sort of looking for something, but it wasn't ultimately something that gave her genuine answers and so on. I don't know. Has that? Do you generally find that people, in your experience, have a positive relationship with psychedelics when they're doing this, or do you find people, you know, I don't know, maybe people's thoughts about it do change over time, inevitably?
Well, I'd say this, that I think Ashley, it's a very interesting article, but it's a very subjective perspective, really, because, I mean, I don't see psychedelics as a competitor to Christianity. I mean, I see it more like, it can be a catalyst for Christianity. For example, in there's this Marsh Chapel experiment, or the Good Friday experiment from 1962, where they gave psilocybin to these theological Protestant students, and they all 10 who took it, there were 10 who took a placebo as well, they all recorded that it had enriched their Christianity and their faith substantially. And then you have a clinical theologian like Frank Lake, who used LSD for helping people using Christianity and acid, LSD. And today I know a number of Christians who integrate psychedelic use with Christianity. So I don't see them at loggerheads at all. I think they're quite harmonious. And I wouldn't like to see them as antagonistic at all. I would say, though, that, of course, yeah, there is a kind of subculture of psychedelic use in the West today, which is a kind of, yeah, it's a Californian-based, it seems, kind of a fusion of Eastern, you know, religions and certain mystical insights from the West and so on, that kind of, in some ways, are antagonistic towards Christianity. For example, pantheism, the Swedish scholar called Patrick Lundberg, who wrote that pantheism is a core virtue of psychedelia, for example, and pantheism is arguably not harmonious with Christianity, although it can be. I mean, you know, there are a lot of arguments about that as well. But you obviously some people don't get what they need from psychedelic experience. It seems like, reading your article at least, you needed some kind of a moral figure, moral guide. I would say, interestingly, a lot of people say, with regard to mysticism generally, if you overlap it, that the mystical experience can take you beyond good and evil. This is what Bertrand Russell said, for example, that you sort of are drawn outside of your culture and you see morality and religion and political ideologies all from an objective point of view. So, it can be antagonistic, but it needn't be. I'd say as well, the history of Christianity, I mean, Christianity has been, a little bit against psychoactive uses. I mean, the Eleusinian Mysteries in ancient Greece, where a number of people believe they took a certain potion, a hallucinogenic potion, that was closed down by Emperor Theodosius I in 392 AD, for Christian reasons, really. And, of course, the conquistadors in South America, they tried to suppress all psychoactive uses of indigenous culture, you know, sort of the cacti and the mushrooms used there, and so on. So there has been this kind of Christian opposition to psychoactive drugs, yet there needn't be.
Right. Well, Ashley, what do you say to all of that? You know, there are these instances where apparently Christians have said it's improved my faith, it's been a benefit in that way.
Yeah, so there was a lot in that, and I have a lot of thoughts. I personally do not know any Christians who have been benefited by psychedelics. I suppose it's possible they're out there, but as Peter said, even though, and I would argue too, in response to the him stating that my article is subjective, I mean, certainly, yes, it is subjective, but all a psychedelic experience is subjective, you know, and the Good Friday experiment, so that's actually not true about the Good Friday experiment. There was at least one of the participants, maybe two, that had a complete panic reaction, and they didn't. And I would also push back against, and I don't know that they said that it enriched their Christianity. A lot of people will say that it was a very meaningful experience. And I mean, the category of meaningful, that isn't necessarily positive. I've had very negative events in my life that have been deeply meaningful. I feel like they've been, God has made them deeply meaningful in the sense of Romans 8:28, that he works all things for our good, but they in and of themselves are not positive experiences. And in particular, I remember listening to Dr. Roland Griffiths, who's the head researcher at the Johns Hopkins Center for Psychedelic Research and Consciousness Research, saying that many people would rate the psilocybin experience as one of the most meaningful experiences of their lives, on par with the birth of their first child. And I remember thinking, it must have been the men who were saying that, because having given birth to two children, naturally, there's no comparison. But so meaningful in and of itself, I mean, and like I said, subjectivity reigns in the world of psychedelia, which is why people splinter off in all kinds of different directions when they're trying to build a cosmology around the psychedelic experience. It has no center. And as Peter said, as disparate as the experiences are and as subjective as they are, pantheism does tend to be a somewhat reliable outcome as far as someone's theological, cosmological outlook. But there's absolutely no guarantee whatsoever.
And just to be clear on the terms here, so pantheism, as Peter sort of briefly explained, is the idea that everything is God in a sense. It's sort of, it puts nature in the place, yes, almost, of God. And you're saying, Ashley, that's a natural outcome of hallucinogenics, because it kind of gives you that sense of experience that you're connected somehow to every living sort of aspect of nature. Is that why you say it's a kind of a natural outcome?
Yeah, it can be. And it also tends to lead to people and I don't know if you would call this a subset of pantheism or if this would be included in pantheism, the idea that we collectively are God, that there's no transcendent God, but we collectively are God. And in response to that, I read a really funny segment of, there's a wonderful book called God's Forever Family, A History of the Jesus People Movement in America by Larry Eskridge. And I actually spoke with him on the phone a couple of days ago, but I was really interested in that book because so many of the people who segued into the Jesus People Movement came out of psychedelic culture. And one of the gentlemen, when they set up their first evangelistic outpost in the Haight-Ashbury, which is, of course, a hotbed of psychedelic drug taking and everything attendant with that culture, Charles Manson was coming in a lot to this evangelistic outpost, and they let him come. You know, he creeped everybody out because he was Charles Manson. But the thing that really made me laugh, and I mean, it's kind of not funny because of who it was, but he came in, Charles Manson was very into psychedelics, particularly LSD. And he came in and said, "I am God." And Ted Wise, who was one of the gentlemen who was ministering to people there, he said, he just guffawed and he said, "Well, if you are God, I am truly disappointed." And I look back and think, like, my own conception of I am God, I was truly disappointed by that. And so there's no reliable cosmology that you can build around the psychedelic experience. Like I said, people go off in all kinds of different directions. And in response to me needing a moral figure, I mean, yeah, absolutely. That's absolutely true. I think all of the human heart needs a moral figure. And Leslie Newbegin, who's one of my favorite theologians, he was a missiologist in India for a long time, and so is deeply acquainted with Hinduism, which is a religion that some people claim emerged from the use of psychedelics, a psychedelic called Soma. There's no hard archaeological evidence for that, but some people claim that. Anyway, and he said that the real mystery at the center of the universe is not a metaphysical mystery. It's not found in contemplating the vastness of things, so that can certainly be fascinating. It's in the mystery of how the holy can embrace the unholy. It's the mystery of grace. And that is the central mystery of the cosmos. And I just found that to be so true in my trajectory in trying to, you know, contemplate these huge metaphysical concepts and ontological concepts and the nature of being and trying to figure it all out. My heart was still not satisfied. And I know, you know, you can look at me and say, like, well, she just needed that, you know, she just couldn't handle it or whatever. But I would argue that we as humans, God has planted eternity in the human heart, and that is what we all long for, and that is the only, Jesus is the only place where we will actually find true fulfillment. And I also would add that something I was thinking recently in preparation for this, and sorry, I'm trying to be quick. There are no pantheistic fairy tales. Like, I believe Peter has children, and I have children, and Justin, I know you have children. And there are no pantheistic fairy tales. And I wondered about that. And I was thinking about, there was a children's book that one of our friends gave us back in the day, you know, when we were all into psychedelics after our son was born. And it actually was a pantheistic children's book. I've never seen another one like it. And it had lines such as, I am, you know, I am in everything. Everything is in me. I am the ball at my feet. I am in everyone I meet. I am the puppy across the street. And my husband and I just looked at each other and, you know, it was just so patently false. Like when you boil these lofty philosophical speculations down to that level, it just becomes so patently, you know, bull.
There's a couple of kind of criticisms coming your way in that sense, Peter. Firstly, something Ashley said early on, which is the cosmology, if you like, as she calls it, around hallucinogenic experiences. It's very hard to actually get anything, you know, concrete out of it. It is by nature a subjective experience. And so when you say it gives you an objective experience on reality and right and wrong and everything, well, surely that itself is by its nature subjective. And then, yes, I mean, obviously, Ashley feels ultimately the kind of pantheism that it perhaps breeds is ultimately, she finds it obviously something of a shallow way of seeing the world. It doesn't map onto really reality once you're off the trip or whatever. So any responses to some of these criticisms?
Well, I mean, you know, a number of things. What you understand by reality is subjective as well. I mean, also, another thing is, I'm not claiming that psychedelic experiences are necessarily objective. Obviously, a lot of them are to do with one's memories and one's life. So that, of course, is subjective. The Unia Mystica that I have spoken of, and other Christians and theologians have spoken of, is supposed to be objective, though. But the question is, how do you know whether to give it that reality or not? So for me, psychedelics don't give me a cosmology. I'm not looking for a cosmology. I don't have a desire for a cosmology. I don't want all the explanations. I don't want the certainty. Obviously, other people need a certainty and a guide in life. I'm not saying psychedelics give you that. In fact, they actually, they could do the opposite. They could make you question everything. And that's fine. I mean, I don't know. I think it's a bit of a strange contrast you have here. You know, there's psychedelics and they're like attempt at a cosmology. And then there's Christianity, which must be true. This is not how I look at it at all. I see psychedelics as potential catalysts to interesting metaphysical perspectives and perspectives on consciousness. I mean, I don't think we'll ever get the absolute answers. But I wouldn't just say that, you know, because psychedelics didn't give me a moral guideline in my life, therefore we should reject it. I mean, it's just a wrong way of looking at it, you know. They're just tools.
What have they done in that sense? Okay, so, but tools to what? How do psychedelics help you live your life better, I suppose?
Okay, well, I mean, you know, as you know, we are at the moment going through the so-called psychedelic renaissance. So there are now, in the last 10 years, multiple tens, if not hundreds of studies on the potential benefits of psychedelics, you know. So, for example, MAPS, the association MAPS, are creating using drugs to treat depression and PTSD. This is one of the main reasons for the Renaissance, that there's money in antidepressants. And instead of psychedelics being harmful to you, as was the propaganda of the sort of 20th century, mid to late 20th century, we're now realizing they have medicinal benefits, which have now been shown to be the case. Now, of course, you can be cynical and say, well, that's Big Pharma getting in on the act and trying to make money out of it, which they probably are. But nonetheless, they seem to be helping people who need it as well. So there's, I mean, if you do suffer from such conditions, then, of course, psychedelics are very, you know, at least the latest science shows that they are very, very beneficial.
Any response to that, Ashley?
So I would say that the evidence thus far is actually quite inconclusive as to whether there are lasting therapeutic benefits. And they are absolutely becoming monetized. Peter Thiel, who's a gajillionaire, he started PayPal with Elon Musk. He just poured $125 million into a German psychedelic startup. So, and that kind of concerns me. Like, why are these huge, you know, magnates getting involved in this research? Like in the 60s, you know, that Peter Thiel would have been considered the man, you know, and it's the man that is pushing these drugs. And that really, I'm not a conspiracy theorist necessarily, but it does make me suspicious.
Can I just, you said the science is inconclusive. Can you tell me which papers are you referring to there?
Yes. So a lot of the papers that I've read, and granted, I don't have an established with an academic institution, so a lot of the papers I can't read them in their entirety. But a lot of the abstracts, for instance, some of the psilocybin studies on depression that are coming out of Johns Hopkins, the follow-up period is only a month later. And I really don't think that's long enough to measure whether there is an enduring change in someone.
Let me go back to the Marsh Chapel experiment. You were right to say that, yes, one of those 10 who took psilocybin did feel anxiety. You're correct about that. However, the other nine,
He panics and he ran down the street, actually.
Okay, so one negative one. And of course, you can have panic attacks if you're not used to this. I mean, even on alcohol, if alcohol wasn't a sort of popular drug in our culture and you gave someone a bottle of whiskey, in one go, I think a lot of people would panic because they couldn't control their bodies and so on, right? But, Rick Doblin of MAPS, he actually did a follow-up study and he got in touch with those people from the Marsh Chapel experiment in 1962 in 1991. And all of those nine, they still maintained that this was a life-changing experiment for them, and it was very beneficial. Okay, it's only nine people, but that's, the longest study that exists. So, and of course, I'm also skeptical of the medicalization of psychedelics, and I think this is why we're seeing a renaissance. However, I mean, it could be, it's not incoherent to say that Big Pharma are making money out of it, but at the same time, people who are suffering from PTSD and depression and so on are also benefiting from it. It need not be a zero-sum game. It can be, winners on both sides. I don't see the problem with that.
I would say that there has been, the Good Friday, and I had heard of that, of Rick Doblin getting in touch with them. Obviously, he has an ideological pre-commitment, And I would say that using psychedelics was one of the more meaningful experiences of my life. It ultimately would have led me to ruin a devastation if I hadn't quit. And I view it now through the lens of God working all things for my good. I wouldn't view it the same way. For several years after I quit psychedelics, I was so wounded and scarred by everything that I had experienced. And it was so injurious that I didn't even want to talk about it. I lived in fear of getting dosed, which is completely irrational, but I did. I was that wounded by it. And so I think when, my husband likes to say, there has been a privately funded, large-scale, diffuse experiment going on for decades now with psychedelics. And I remember I was very evangelistic about psychedelics back when I was taking a lot of LSD by myself. I had a boyfriend at the time. This was obviously before I met my husband. I was just proselytizing about and just waxing poetic about psychedelics, how wonderful they were. If everyone could just take them, it would change the world. And my boyfriend had taken them, but he wasn't into them like I was. And he interjected and he said, millions of people took psychedelics in the 60s and have since, and it hasn't changed anything. And I was really, really deflated by that. And it really took the wind out of my sails. But the problem,
how do you know it didn't change things? I mean, there's a big legacy of how it sort of, has caused, the peace movement, ecology movement, and so on and so forth. I mean, you don't know what the world would have been like if that hadn't happened.
That's true. I mean, we don't know what the world would have been like if a lot of things hadn't happened. I mean,
precisely. So you can't really make the statement. Secondly, why are you so extreme with this? You were like extremely into psychedelics, and now you're extremely into Christianity. Why not just keep an open mind and say, this is an interesting experience. We needn't even call it religious. We can call it aesthetic, if you like. It's a beautiful experience, as you said yourself, and it can be fearful as well. No doubt there's a very interesting aspect of dark psychedelic experiences. And I don't, when you say I advocate them, I don't advocate people to take them. I advocate the sort of research into them, let's say. Why not just keep an open mind and say, my experience with psychedelics was positive to start with, then it turned negative, and then I turned to Christianity, and that gave me something more that I personally was looking for. However, for other people, it could go the other way around. You could start as a Christian, and that might not give you enough, and then you turn to psychedelia, and maybe it will enrich your Christianity, or it will lead you elsewhere. I don't see why the radicalization.
Go ahead, Ashley.
Jesus is very radicalizing, so I think that's part of it. I mean, Jesus requires I was very into the Gnostic Gospels. I would have said, I didn't read the Bible when I was into psychedelics, but I would have said things like, oh, I'm sure Moses was totally tripping when he saw the burning bush, you know, and I'm sure these things could all be tied to psychedelics because it became this totalizing theory for me. But I would never linger on Jesus. I certainly would never linger on Jesus on the cross.
Yeah, but why? Okay, so Jesus is radical, but why the radicality in psychedelia as well? You had radicality on both sides, it seems.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'm kind of extreme like that, I guess. But I did not see the fruit in my own life. I think experientially is a large part of it. And then I see these people, and I have never seen fruit in it in other people's lives. And I was part of a large network of people who were taking psychedelics in preparation for this podcast.
What do you mean by fruit?
What do I mean by fruit? I mean enduring positive transformation in someone's life. I mean, Christianity, like people can say, oh, I feel like a more loving
person. Can
I finish this?
Okay, but I mean, I feel like you're painting a very negative portrayal of something that has helped a lot of people.
Well, I'll come back to you, Peter, for some positive portrayal of this. Let's just, you finish it off, Pashley, though. Why do you feel overall that the trend has been negative in your experience?
Yeah, because I think that psychedelics are a very inwardly directed thing, and love, actual tangible love in Christianity, is very outward directed. So I think someone can say that, yes, I've become more loving, I understand, I feel at one with the universe, but I just wonder, like, this is the reality in which we find ourselves, you know, this is the reality that God has provided to us. And if someone isn't actively loving out in the world, you know, like God said, or Jesus said, when asked what the greatest commandment is, he said, you know, number one is love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul. And number two is like that. It's inextricable from it. It's so entwined as to be inextricable from it, is love your neighbor as yourself. So I have never, you know, and obviously the church is not perfect. There's going to be dysfunction wherever people are. But as far as people taking care of one another and caring for one another and being deeply invested in one another's lives and loving sacrificially, I never found that in the New Age and psychedelic community, which is not to say that there weren't nice people who were generous, you know, but I just, comparatively, the fruit, I don't see it, and I have not seen it.
Let's hear from you again, Peter. Why do you feel that this is too negative a portrayal then of the effects of psychedelics?
Well, as well as, you know, a lot of scientific studies from, you know, Johns Hopkins, Imperial College, and so on, showing the benefits to people from psychedelics. I know many people who have benefited from them. There are conferences and a whole circle of people who do it. Also, psychedelics need not be associated with the New Age movement. I mean, these are two separate things that overlap. But they need, you know, you get the right wing in psychedelia. Figures like Ernst Jünger, you know, Albert Hofmann's good friend. He was a Nazi, but he was sort of advocating for, and essentially, he became Christian later, but essentially you don't need to associate psychedelics with the New Age. And I just don't see the antagonism there. I mean, again, you're painting this portrait of two things that are fighting, but they are mutually inclusive. They can be mutually inclusive. And it's, you know, like I say, there's a whole movement of Christianity and psychedelia here in Britain, at least, you know. So I just don't want people to think...
Ashley's concern seems to be that it doesn't involve... It's a kind of inward-focused thing, and... Even
it's
that
not
concern that you have to take a particular substance to it to kind of experience, this. Is it kind of? I guess that would be my, you know, yeah.
Well, okay, a number of things. I mean, traditionally, psychedelic use is a communal thing, you know, in South America and so on and so forth, with ayahuasca and whatnot. Secondly, you could say about Christianity that it's an inward thing, you know, that it's something personal and to the heart. I mean, of course, you can have it, you can do your sermons in church and whatever, but it needn't be like that. It can be quite isolated. And then I go back again to the Christian mystics and monks, you know, who wanted to isolate themselves, fast, diet, and so on, in order to induce similar experiences. So my point there is that Christianity and these exceptional experiences, whether they are occasioned by chemicals or whether they are occasioned by other techniques such as breathing or meditation or prayer or whatever, they are not mutually exclusive. And also I should say another thing about compassion. One last thing, sorry. there is this sense of unity that we spoke of makes one a lot of people feel that they are connected to everyone else and to nature. And that, of course, gives a moral framework for appreciating the planet and others. You know, it has, it sort of enriches compassion in many ways.
Well, we'll come back to that and see what Ashley has to say in response. Loving this debate, though, on the place of psychedelics, Christianity, and whether there is whether they are mutually exclusive or not is sort of where we've got to on today's discussion on an Unbelievable. But my guests are Ashley Landy and Peter Sjersted Hughes, and we're going to continue the discussion and finish it up in just a moment. Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable. We'll get some of your feedback, though not time for too much this week, because Ben Jacobs from Genexis is going to be joining me shortly to tell us all about what's coming up for their new season of talks at the end of September in Coventry and London. But you can get in touch with the show as ever at UnbelievableJB for Twitter, to get me on Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB to follow the show on Facebook. You can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Now, Ryan tweeted out a lovely message. For anyone interested in Christian apologetics, Justin puts on a great weekly podcast called Unbelievable. The typical format is a conversation between Justin and both a Christian and skeptic, covering a variety of topics. Hashtag Christianity. Do share the word, as Ryan kindly has on Twitter or Facebook or wherever you do your social media. And of course, via podcast as well. If you rate and review this podcast, if that's the way you're listening, then it helps others to discover the show as well. Thanks, Ryan. And we'll hear a bit more feedback later on in the show. Tonight at 8 p.m. on The Profile, Dr. Michael Gillen joins me. He's a former Harvard physics instructor and Emmy Award-winning news science editor. He's going to be talking to me about his new book, Believing is Seeing, which tells the story of his journey from atheism to Christianity via science, and why everyone needs to examine their own worldview. Really interesting conversation with Michael on The Profile. You can find that also on its own Profile podcast, wherever you get your podcast from. Next week here on Unbelievable, we're doing the big vegan debate. Yes, by popular demand, a lot of people asking for this debate over the last few years. We're going to be asking, should Christians eat meat? And on the side of vegetarianism slash veganism is Greg Boyd, well-known Christian theologian and pastor, who is a vegetarian transitioning to vegan. On the side of being a carnivorous Christian is Joshua D. Jones, author of Elijah Men Eat Meat and an advocate of low-carb majority meat diets. So that will be an interesting one. And we've got more ethical debates coming your way this autumn. We're going to be debating assisted dying. That's coming up in Parliament soon again. A bill is going through Parliament on that. Abortion in Texas, their new fetal heartbeat legislation has been causing controversy. We're going to try and put a show together on that. Maybe tell me, who would you like to see in conversation on that? Your suggestions, very welcome. And we've also got shows lining up on things like woke Christianity and Islamic apologetics, seeing if we can line up Hatun Tash for that, who was attacked at Hyde Park over the summer. Obviously, those issues around Islamic extremism being highlighted, especially this weekend, 20 years on from 9/11. So lots of stuff, lots of interesting stuff coming up on Unbelievable this autumn. Right now, though, back into our conversation on getting high with the Most High.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's discussion. A really interesting, quite feisty, but enjoyable one. Hallucinogens, psychedelics, that's what we're talking about. Getting high with the Most High. Ashley Landy and Peter Sjersted Hughes are both with me. Now, let me give you links before the show ends to where you can find out more. A link to Ashley's article for Fathom Mag with today's show. Go and check that out to read her story in full. Extremely well written, by the way. I really actually just enjoyed reading it. You're a great writer, Ashley. So your journalistic background was coming through there. Peter's website is philosopher.eu, and there's a link to that as well, and you'll find there things like his TED talk on these issues, which I'm sure you'll find enlightening. Well, just getting back into this, I mean, Peter made the case for the sort of the religious use of psychedelics communally. You know, they've been used. It's not just a kind of introspective, I'm by myself kind of thing necessarily, Ashley. And generally has been saying we shouldn't see them as mutually exclusive. They didn't work for you, Ashley, but they have been very beneficial for other people. So, yeah, where do you go with that? And indeed, I suppose the whole history that's been pointed out by people, and I may be mispronouncing the name here, is it Murarescu, who has done a sort of whole book on why he thinks that, you know, Christianity has sort of psychedelic roots and that sort of thing. Be interested in your responses to that as well, Ashley, as we start to close up.
Yeah. So as far as Peter mentioned psychedelic use and community in South America, and it's really interesting. To their credit, I kind of got on this thread through an article that was posted by the Johns Hopkins Center for Psychedelic Study. It was a Vice article talking about how historical indigenous psychedelic usage is not nearly as widespread, like nowhere near as widespread and common as is being claimed. And that has just been kind of co-opted into the narrative. You hear people state that, you know, without any qualification, as though it's just, you know, objective truth that these substances have been used for thousands of years in all these indigenous cultures. And of course, in South America and the Amazon, there's a huge tourism industry that is built up around ayahuasca. I mean, talk about colonializing. Like, I can't see how that's necessarily been good for the native people. But I also, it was interesting, I found this article, or excuse me, documentary on YouTube called Magical Death. And it was produced by the University of Pennsylvania Department of Anthropology in 1970, I believe. And it was a portrayal of these ayahuascan shamans and how they used ayahuasca. And they were somehow grinding it, making it into a powder and snorting it through this long tube. But the way that they use it, and then, of course, there was a narrator narrating all this, it was quite unsettling to watch. They would snort it just, and it wasn't as though they were using it therapeutically. I think we as Westerners have imposed this therapeutic paradigm on it. But for them, it was very much a portal into the spirit world. And for them specifically, in this instance that was being filmed, it was a portal into the spirit world in order to summon this demon that would eat the souls of their enemy tribe's children. And that was the purpose. I mean, that was the purpose of it. They talked about how this one healer had a demon that he regularly summoned in the spirit world and called on this demon to inflict punishment on the enemy tribe. And so it's interesting. I mean, on one hand, I've heard that the ayahuascan shamans, they do believe it, you know, it's a cure for what ails you. And so they would use it more in a sense of physical ailments for people in their tribe. But as far as this Western therapeutic paradigm being posed on it, that's just really not what indigenous use has been like. They were very clear that it was a portal to the spiritual world. And there's an anthropologist named Bernd Brabeck de Mori, who actually, he lived in the Amazon for years. He married a Shipibo woman. And his presupposition going down there was that, oh, they've used this for thousands of years. And through his research and his living among these people, he completely changed his hypothesis and said, oh, this is actually, it's just spread through the Amazon. Actually, interestingly enough, with the advent of the missionaries and, you know, business harvesting businesses, like within the last 200 years, it's spread throughout the Amazon. So the evidence for an indigenous use is just not, it's just not there.
Mm. Okay. Peter.
Well, that's wrong. That's just false. I mean, there's a lot of anthropologists have spoken about the use through thousands of years. I mean, and not just in the Americas. I mean, in Europe, we have, of course, the Greek mysteries, Dionysian mysteries, Eleusinian mysteries. It is alleged used a psychedelic potion, though it's not proved. Interestingly, there was these kind of almost conspiracy theorists, people like Chris Bennett and Danny Nemu, who spoke about drugs in the Bible and sort of a Christian basis of or a psychedelic basis of Christianity. And this was kind of, you know, left to the sidelines of academia. But interestingly, last year, archaeologists in Israel, in Tel Arad, found in an 8th century BC Jewish temple, sort of remains of frankincense and cannabis in the inner sanctum of the temple there, which was quite revolutionary because it shows that there was cannabis use at least, you know, 800 BC. And of course, also the Rig Veda speaks, as you mentioned, of the Soma. And there's a Matthew Clark has got a great new book about this. You know, what were the ingredients of that according to the best evidence? Of course, the Rig Veda is 3,000 to 3,500 years old. So that, and there's a lot of evidence of use. I mean, throughout ancient civilizations, the Delphic Oracle and so on and so forth,
And linked to religious. Linked to religious experience and belief. So
in ancient Greece, I mean, Plato, you know, all the Greeks basically went to the Eleusinian mysteries, and the ultimate purpose was to get rid of the fear of death. And now, whether they took a potion there called Kaikion of a certain dose, and you had to fast. So many scholars say that this probably contained some psychedelic, like ergot. Albert Hofmann, who discovered LSD, said it was probably ergot, which is the basis of LSD, a sort of parasite on barley. But anyway, whatever it was, the experiences therein was, you could say, were religious. They were, you know, they induced visions. Plato speaks about that, for example, in the Phaedo and the Phaedrus, and the Neoplatonists sort of continued this mystical tradition. So there's a lot of historical evidence for this. I wouldn't dismiss it. I mean, it's not anything in history, of course, is open to interpretation, but it seems more likely than not.
Yeah. Okay. So passing it back to you, Ashley. Firstly, obviously, I think you're going to have to agree to disagree on the question of the communal aspect of this, how far back it goes among these peoples and so on. But this is an important point. And as I said, people like Brian Murarescu have been talking about the so-called psychedelic roots of Christianity and so on. So what do you think about those claims that lots of religions, including Christianity, have their roots in psychedelic type experiences and drugs?
Yeah, I think it's symptomatic of how psychedelics become a totalizing theory for so many people. Once they really get enmeshed in them, they become this totalizing theory, and then people feel as though they have to shoehorn everything else. I mean, I was like that, you know, back in the day. Like I said, I would have said, oh, when Moses saw the burning bush, he was totally tripping, definitely, no question. And so, yeah, it becomes this totalizing theory.
I would never say that.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Anyway, so there is a lack of hard, and I knew about the cannabis traces that were found in that temple. I mean, that's one instance. I don't think that's really sufficient to build any kind of a theory on. As far as the Eleusinian mystery cults go, according to Manly P. Hall, I have this book called The Secret Teachings of All Ages. According to Manly P. Hall, women and children were initiated into the mystery cult. So that makes me wonder, were they dosing children? And
That's not right.
As far as the Kai, how do you know? You don't know. No one knows. It was a mystery cult. Nobody knows.
Well, no.
But anyway,
all Greeks were allowed in the Eleusinian mysteries.
No one has ever been able to
I mean, all Greeks were allowed in except for slaves and people who couldn't speak Greek. That's a known fact.
Including children. Okay, excluding slaves. So it was an elitist organization. And so the Kaikion, we've never been able to recreate. Like no one, you would think with modern chemistry, we would be able to recreate that. Nobody's ever been able to recreate it. And there were a lot of mystery cults in the ancient world. There was the Eleusinian mystery cult. There was another mystery cult called the Cybelian mystery cult. And at the Cybelian mystery cult, so they worship Cybele. I don't know if I'm saying pronouncing that correctly. But they worshipped her, and the adherents would whip themselves up into such a frenzy they would self-flagellate, and they would also often castrate themselves because they believed that she demanded eunuchs in her service. So, you know, I can't imagine why that one isn't more popular.
Well,
people aren't talking about that one.
Roman Catholicism has a similar history.
Ashley, I did want to ask you, though, about the kind of the spiritual dimension of this, Ashley. I get the sense that you don't believe it's just a kind of just a bad trip, just, you know, that you had a negative experience. Presumably, as a Christian, you do believe there is a spiritual forces at work here, and that you obviously believe that there are instances,
and
you reference this documentary, where there are people calling on demonic forces and using psychoactive drugs to kind of facilitate that in some way. Now, obviously, I'm guessing you're going to be look at this very differently from Peter at this point, but for you as a Christian, you do believe actually there's this negative spiritual dimension that's at work in this. So just talk about that briefly, and we'll see what Peter has to say in response.
Yes, and I'll be as brief as possible. I would like to share two specific incidents along that line that happened in my own life. When I was using LSD frequently, and again, Peter could claim these are subjective experiences, but I have a difficult time not thinking that they...
You yourself said it's subjective.
It's all subjective, Peter. It's all subjective. Like, everything is an article of faith. Everything. Everything is an article of faith. Everything requires a faith commitment. So anyway, it was when I was heavily using LSD, And I had not taken LSD this particular night. I woke up in the middle of the night. I saw this kind of column of smoke in the corner of my room, and it was not opaque. It was had a diaphanous quality, so I knew that it wasn't an intruder. So I thought, okay, this isn't real. I'm going back to sleep. This isn't real. And at that moment, I had this little dog named Gene Hackman, and he bristled. He woke up. He bristled. He began growling and barking very specifically toward this corner of the room. I lived on the second floor of an apartment. There wasn't anyone walking by. And another incident that just recently, there's a website that I'm not going to name, but it's a well-known website among psychedelics users. You can go and read, you know, all kinds of trip reports of people on any substance, including, you know, traditional narcotics like heroin and cocaine, but a lot of it is on psychedelics. And I remember when I smoked Salvia divinorum at one point when I was using psychedelics. I only did it once. It was a very powerful experience. It wasn't a negative experience at the time. And I guess a lot of people, a very high percentage of people do have negative experiences with Salvia. I didn't know that at the time, fortunately. But anyway, a part of my experience, and this is going to sound completely absurd, but a part of my experience, and it does take you completely to another world. Like you are no longer in the room. But one part of that experience was like I said, this is going to sound absolutely absurd, but I was on this water wheel, and there was either a ravioli or a postage stamp that was a cartoon character, and it had Mickey Mouse hands and a Mickey Mouse voice. And it said to me, it kept beckoning me, and it kept saying, "Come on, hurry up. We got to go. Come on." And, you know, after that was over, I was like, well, that was bizarre, you know, whatever that was. And, but then a few days ago, I was going on Arrowhead, and I thought, I'm going to read some Salvia reports, you know, and see what other people have experienced. And the first one I clicked on, this gentleman who wrote this, I guess it was a gentleman, people use pseudonyms, but he had a very bad experience. But at one part of the experience, he encountered this child. He said it looked like an orphan, like a Dickensian orphan child who was in tattered. And this child was beckoning to him and saying, "Come on, hurry up. We gotta go. Hurry." And I got a little freaked out by that. And I look at that and I think, how is that not a spirit? Like, how could that be explained materialistically, you know, that a compound could trigger that specific of a virtually identical, except for the appearance, you know, in this me and this other person who I don't know, you know, who has different life experiences than me. So I was really, I feel like that was confirming for me. There's no way I could explain that materialistically. So I think it absolutely opens people up to a different dimension. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Peter, any comments on that? We are starting to approach the end here, so I'll ask you to be brief.
Well, by saying that, I mean, you're accepting the fact that these psychedelics do open up a metaphysical reality. All right, which is kind of what you were arguing against a moment ago,
yeah,
saying it was.
For sure.
But then you were saying before it's subjective, illusory.
No, I never argued against that.
Well, you said they were subjective.
Well, yeah.
So not,
I mean,
not. But now you're saying. But now you're
our
saying.
Experiences are subjective.
Okay, but now you're saying it's objective, right? So, but the interesting fact there is it opens up from a philosophical point of view. I'm not taking.
No.
I'm not taking sides.
You're conflating two different things. Yeah.
Okay, maybe I am. Maybe I'm not. But anyway, no. From a philosophical.
You're just conflating two different things.
From a philosophical point of view. It's interesting, you know, it opens up interesting questions like this. And my personal view is I don't take a dogmatic view one way or the other, you know. I'm just open-minded to it. and I think this is the way we should treat psychedelics, as interesting tools for mental exploration. That's what they are. They're not as harmful as people think.
Whereas you would take a more cautious approach in that, Ashley. Presumably you believe that we're dealing with something that should be treated carefully, not just
absolutely we're dealing with something completely out of our depth. And I want to say too that acid casualties are not a fabrication that was propagated by the DEA or someone. Almost every I talk to probably 10 different people, one of whom is my contemporary as far as age and took a lot of DMT before becoming a Christian, and the other whom came out of the original psychedelic revolution in the 60s. Every single one of them knew firsthand, not secondhand. So it's not, you know, my plumber's brother's cousin's friend. knew firsthand someone who was either institutionalized or who no longer, you know, completely had their mental faculties due to psychedelic use. So these aren't, you know, these cautionary tales, they aren't myths. They aren't myths. They're real.
That's anecdote. But look at this. Look at the science. Okay, that kind of thing is terrible, terrible propaganda, which has stopped research into these chemicals. The fact is, I mean, okay, I might have known someone who said something about something. Okay, it doesn't prove anything. Look at a study by The Lancet with David Nutt and those figures. You know, you should see that LSD, psilocybin, and most of the psychedelics are relatively harmless, whereas alcohol and heroin, they are very harmful. And so we should make the separation between psychedelics and the rest of the drugs. You know, it's very important.
Okay. We are just about out of time, I'm afraid, folks. It's been a fascinating discussion, and I've enjoyed the liveliness of it along the way as well. So thank you both, Ashley and Peter, for being on the show today. I will make sure there are links to both of your websites, your talks, your books, and the article, Ashley, in your case, where you can find out more about this and pursue it if you're interested. But for now, thank you so much for such an interesting conversation on the show today. Thanks for being with me, Ashley.
Thank you,
Peter.
Thank you, Ashley. And I'm sorry for any discourtesy, but I've really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
I have too. It's been fun.
Turned into quite a feisty debate in the end, didn't it? But thanks again to Ashley and Peter for being my guests on the show this week. If you've got a thought on it yourself, why not email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can find us on social media too, @unbelievablejb for the Twitter, facebook.com/unbelievablejb for the Facebook page. I'm also over on Instagram and TikTok as justin.briley. Coming up shortly, I'm going to be speaking to Ben Jacobs of Genexis about their events in Coventry and London towards the end of this month. But just before we get to Ben, let's read some of your comments on last week's show. Bit different. It was the dialogue about a dialogue, if you will. This was when Victoria Lim and Steve Robinson joined me to talk about, as two scientists, their three-year dialogue and the conversion of Victoria in the end to Christianity. A lot of appreciation for this show. On Twitter, Scott Hawley, who is himself from Belmont University, where Dr. Steve Robinson is a physics tutor, says, fascinating conversation between my physics colleague, Dr. Steve Robinson, and former student Dr. Victoria Lim with Justin. Robinson filmed his part in our acoustics instruction lab. I did not know that, but thanks for telling me, Scott. And Keith Plummer, a longtime listener of the show, says, grateful for these periodic deviations from the regular format. Much to learn here about prayerful patience, genuine friendship, and mutual respect, evangelism and apologetics, and looking forward to reading their book. Thanks, Keith. Steve Robinson himself over on the YouTube channel got in touch. Inevitably, YouTube, you know, can be a bit of a bear pit when it comes to the comments. We all know that, don't we? And Steve Robinson got in touch there with those who were leaving comments about the show, saying, hey, everyone, I'm honoured that you stopped by to watch our video. Also thrilled that many of you are actively engaging in the same sorts of conversations Victoria and I had. But please be kind to each other. Keep in mind that our dialogue took place over 3 years and 300 plus pages. Thus, it's impossible to appropriately address the many nuanced issues we talked about in these YouTube comments, and I won't try. If you find yourself firmly on one side and unwilling to entertain ideas from the other side, the book will be of little use to you. However, if you have an open mind and are curious as to how we came to our conclusions, I encourage you to visit our website. Do go back and listen to the show if you haven't yet. Really interesting dialogue between Steve and Victoria. Well, it's great to have joining me on the show now, Ben Jacobs from Genexis. Genexis is a fantastic project that's been going on the last couple of years, really. Obviously, COVID, like everything, took its toll on what they were able to do last year. But I've been really pleased to be involved at various levels with it, both helping to get the word out, helping to present some of the sessions and things like that. But Ben's here to tell us what it is, if you haven't heard of it, and what's coming up at the end of this month, September, both in Coventry and London, some fantastic in-person events with some brilliant speakers and super interesting topics. So, Ben, welcome to the show.
Hi there, Justin. It's great to be with you again. It's been a little while, but yeah, we've had a fun pandemic, like a lot of people had to pivot and change directions a little bit. But we're busy preparing for these events in September, which are getting there now. And
yeah, I was going to say, before we leap into the events, just a quick sort of, elevator pitch. What is Genexis for those who haven't come across it before?
So Genexis is a series of free events exploring big questions So this year we're coming to Coventry Cathedral and Lincoln's Inn in London. And we like to look at questions like the nature of the universe, our place within it. And all of that really to ponder the question, is there a God? And we try to do that in an open way. We're not trying to sort of force an answer down, but we want to open up the conversation. So I guess in a similar way to what you do with Unbelievable, think about some of these big questions, open them up and help people just to think through what it means for them in their lives.
Yeah. And I know that in the first season, as it were, that you did back in 2019, there was, just fantastic number of people who attended at Coventry Cathedral to see people like John Lennox and N.T. Wright and Sharon Dirks and Dennis Alexander and Paul Davies and loads of just super interesting people across the world of physics, science, philosophy. Wonderful response to the talks they gave. Last year, then, during COVID, you put on some special online events, which, again, very well attended, really interesting. But you're back to in person, aren't you?
Yeah, so we're back in person on the 20th, 21st and 22nd of September at Coventry Cathedral. And then again, the repeated event in London on the 27th, 28th and 29th of September at Lincoln's Inn. You can get tickets online for free at www.genexis.org/tickets for those events. But we're joined by some really exciting speakers this year, some new ones. So we've got Professor Tom McLeish from York University, the University of York. We've got Tom Holland, who listeners of your show will know well. Really excited to hear him.
Not the Spider-Man actor, the historian whose book Dominion has been making waves over the last couple of years. Yeah, absolutely. Great speaker. Yeah, I'm really glad you've got Tom involved. Who else is coming on?
So we've got the Reverend Stephen Foster, who is a really interesting guy. He's going to be coming on. He was a criminal barrister for 10 years in London, and then he became a curate at HGB, was on their staff team there, where he led Alpha UK. And so he's got a really interesting story. He's going to be looking at evidence and what the evidence for Christianity looks like and whether that can be trusted, and bring some of his legal expertise into that arena.
Brilliant. I can also see, and I'm looking on the website here right now, genexis.org. You've got some other fantastic speakers returning. Professor John Lennox, always a wonderful speaker. Paul Davies, Ard Louis, Andy Bannister, and N.T. Wright, and Sharon Dirks, among others. So you've got an amazing lineup here of various different people. I mean, you tend to cover a wide range of things. I'm looking again at the topics here: numbers, time, science, chaos, suffering, rights, the cross, evidence, witnesses. So what's the idea? What are you hoping someone who comes to each night will kind of walk away with if they came to every one of the events?
Yeah, so our first evening is looking at questions of science, really. So there's a session by John Lennox on maths, looking at why is the universe understandable through this thing called maths, and it is. How is it understandable through maths, and why is it that such a reliable way of thinking about the universe? Paul Davies will be sharing about time, thinking about why is there time, and why is that an awkward thing, and why the universe looks like it doesn't have to be in time or have time. So why is that the case? That's what Paul's going to be sharing with us. So there's a science theme to the first evening. The second evening, there is more of a philosophical theme, thinking about questions of life. Sharon will be sharing about suffering, and suffering is obviously a very difficult question for theists, but also it's a difficult question for non-theists too. So to be looking at that, Sharon's going to be looking at that. Andy Bannister is going to be sharing on rights. One of my favourite Unbelievable shows was Andy talking to Peter Singer about the issue of human rights came up in that. And so I'm looking forward to hearing him come and share in on that. And then the final evening takes more of a historical theme, looking at the facts of Christianity. Tom Holland will be talking about the impact of the cross. N.T. Wright will be talking about whether the New Testament can be used as a witness, as it were. And Stephen Foster will be looking at the evidence for Christianity from a legal perspective.
Well, as you say, many of these names very familiar to Unbelievable listeners and viewers, because we've featured many of them over the years. And so it'll be an absolute treat, I think. Here's the amazing thing. It's free. I still can't get over this. You guys putting this on for free every time, but somehow you're doing it. So it's a great way, if you like, you know, to return to an in-person event, looking at these really interesting big questions. Now the dates. So as you say, it's basically the same material as being repeated in Coventry. So starting in Coventry and then being repeated the following week in London, isn't it? So if you're in the kind of Coventry Midlands kind of area, the dates to put in your diary and go and book your tickets for are Monday the 20th, Tuesday the 21st, and Wednesday the 22nd in the evening. And that's at Coventry Cathedral. So big, you know, big venue in the centre of Coventry there. And then London the following week, Monday the 27th, Tuesday the 28th, Wednesday the 29th of September. And give me the venue for that one again.
So that's at the Old Hall in Lincoln's Inn, which is an old law chambers in London, near Covent Garden.
Fantastic. And I think if it's anything like the last events, I'm sure it will be, it's going to be really enjoyable. And lots of opportunity for people to engage and see what's going on as well. So I thoroughly recommend it. It comes with the unbelievable stamp of approval, Genexis. do check it out. The website is genexis.org, just to sort of see generally what it's about, see the speakers and that kind of thing. But go to genexis.org/tickets to go and book in via Eventbrite. As I say, completely free. Why not bring a friend, tell others about it as well. I really enjoyed being involved in the events I've been involved in over the last year or two. But Ben, thanks for telling us about it. And we hope it goes really well in Coventry and London.
Thank you, Justin. Look forward to seeing you there.
Well, that's just about all for this week. Thanks for being with us. Do make sure to come back next time. Tonight on The Profile, Dr. Michael Gillen is my guest, former Harvard physics instructor and award-winning news science editor. His new book is called Believing is Seeing, about his own journey from atheism to Christianity via science. You can hear that at 8 p.m. tonight here on Premier Christian Radio or on its own Profile podcast. Let me tell you what's coming up next week on Unbelievable. The big vegan debate. Should Christians eat meat? Greg Boyd defends the vegetarian perspective. Well-known Christian theologian and pastor. And our carnivorous Christian is Joshua D. Jones, author of Elijah Men Eat Meat and an advocate of low-carb majority meat diets. Should be an interesting one. See you then.